My name's Professor James Walvin. I'm a historian and I'm a Manchester United fan. But tonight I'm standing outside Manchester City's football ground in East Manchester on the eve of a big European game between Manchester City and Barcelona. If you ask many people around the world today what they think of Manchester, they'll almost certainly tell you it's a place that's dominated by, characterised by football, by two major teams. And indeed tonight people will be watching this game in all corners of the globe. But what I want to do is actually tell the story of this city in a slightly different way. Not merely tell you the story about football, but tell you how this city, over a period of about 200 years, made such an impact on the world in so many different ways. You're listening to A City United on the BBC World Service with me, Professor James Walvin. Drinking in the morning sun. Something else that Manchester is famous for, or should I say infamous, is its climate. And as unlikely as it sounds, without it, Manchester would not be the city it is today or was in the past. You might recognise this tune, a worldwide hit from the band Elbow. Only a lyricist from this part of the world could exclaim he would be happy with one glorious sunny day a year. Yes, it rains a lot in Manchester. C.P. Lee lectures on film studies at Salford University and is an expert on Manchester's musical and cultural history.
Guy Garvey from Elbow described it as like living inside a Tupperware box. It was always this grey hue overhead, and it's true. Well, maybe it's the damp that's made us want to have more fun.
This is what French social scientist Alex de Tocqueville wrote in 1832.
On this watery land, which nature and art have contributed to keep damp, are scattered palaces and hovels. 30 or 40 factories rise on the tops of hills I have just described. Their 6 stories tower up. Their huge enclosures give notice from afar of the centralization of industry. The wretched dwellings of the poor are scattered haphazard around them. The land is given over to industry's use. Putrid, stagnant pools are found here and there among the houses and over the bumbly, pitted surfaces of the public places.
Yet less than a century before de Tocqueville wrote his account, there was little to indicate that Manchester was about to explode into global consciousness.
But you see that in the suburbs, don't you?
Inside Chetham's library, the city's oldest surviving structure, you can find a series of contemporary maps. They are fascinating because, in effect, they are like aerial photos of the expanding city during the pre- and post-industrial period. Hannah Barker, head of history at Manchester University, studies the city and its people in the later 18th century.
So Manchester in 1750 has got basically one main street running through it, Deansgate, but it's very small, and certainly compared to Liverpool in this period, it's tiny and pretty insignificant. It's not a commercial town at this period.
What is Manchester now? What is Manchester in 1750?
It's a small service town that has more shops than other towns around it that people will come to if they want to buy goods and services. But if they want to do real trade, or if they want to buy something really exotic in this period, they'd probably go to Liverpool if they live in Lancashire.
What sort of people live in Manchester, and what do they do?
Well, there'll be some merchants, some richer people, but mostly this will be a city of shopkeepers and workers.
A century later, the city is so large the map won't even fit on the table.
The map
from 1831, which is when the first... this is a census year, isn't it? So in 1831, the population of Manchester is around 140,000. At the time of the first map we looked at, it's probably not even 20,000. So it's risen really exponentially. And I think the thing you notice with this map, we're not even looking at the whole map, we're looking at half the map here because we can't fit it on the table, is just that the growth has continued in all directions. So areas that were fields and were countryside before are now parts of the city. It's actually, this is my nerdy point here, but it's actually around 1820 that street numbering changes in Manchester. Oh. Before then, you would number down one side of the street, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then back up the other side of the street. The problem with that was when you added new houses to the end of your street, you had to renumber the whole street. So it's in about 1820 that they start numbering in the way that we know today in British streets, which is odd numbers on one side, even numbers on the other side.
So you can always keep up with it.
That allows for growth without having to constantly renumber your streets.
That's a really important point, isn't it?
So what happened? It's 50 years since I lived in Manchester, but Jonathan Schofield pounds the streets most days. He's a city guide, and few know more about what happened here and why than he.
Cotton became fashionable, you could access it in Liverpool, so all this area that was doing wool production just transferred on the west to cotton production, which was much more profitable, make money much quicker. At the same time, there was an explosion in new technologies and steam technologies, and at the same time, it had everything else right. It had the right water for bleaching, you know, it had soft water, not hard water. A little bit later, they could exploit the salt that was in Cheshire, you know, you had the coal next door, so it was a perfect storm. And it was free, so therefore you had the freedom to come to Manchester and lose all you had and end up in the gutter, or the freedom to make a fortune and grow large and grow very prosperous.
Terry Wyke is a specialist in industrial history at Manchester Metropolitan University. And on a suitably gloomy afternoon, he took me down to a complex of canals, today on the western edge of the city centre.
We're sitting actually in one of the key places where the Industrial Revolution began. This is the Castlefield Basin.
When I was a young man, it was a ruin of crumbling warehouses set around a neglected canal basin. Today, it's home to trendy bars and waterside apartments. But in the 18th century, something happened here that proved crucial to the perfect storm of circumstances Jonathan Schofield was speaking of.
The Bridgewater Canal has every claim to be the world's first modern canal. That is to say, although canals had existed for centuries before the middle of the 18th century, the Bridgewater Canal did something that other canals had never done, and that was to move away from a river and to move inland. So this was an entirely new venture, and it was built for one specific reason. The reason being coal. Manchester was already growing by the middle of the 18th century, and there was something of a coal shortage. And the Duke of Bridgewater, who had coal mines some 7 miles away from the centre of Manchester at Worsley, decided on this ambitious, some said at the time very foolish project, to build a canal that connected his coal mines to Manchester.
There are what look like old warehouses over there. Behind us we've got and can hear the trains, the trams. I mean, in a way, we're sitting right at the centre for some of the great transformations that make Manchester what it becomes in the 19th century.
Absolutely, and even before the cotton factories began to be built in Manchester from the 1780s onwards, this area around here had already become a magnet for industry.
Cotton factories, cotton warehouses, cotton barges and cotton trading houses. In the blink of an eye, Manchester became Cottonopolis. In the opening decades of the 19th century, Manchester and its satellite towns, such as Oldham and Rochdale, became home to a noise and to a crush of people never before seen in the world. Philippa Cave is an expert guide to the city's industrial heritage. I met her in Ancoats, the world's first industrial suburb, which in outline, at least, looks as much today as it did then.
You heard Manchester before you saw it. As you approached Manchester, you'd see these massive clouds of black smoke and fog hanging over this place.
You'd hear crunching wheels of machinery, the shrieking of steam from boiler engines, an incessant regular beat of the loom. And if you think of all the smoke, as we walk down the street towards these mills, you can imagine these huge buildings emerging in a rather mysterious, magical way. So you can see why it began to capture people's imagination, because this was like nothing that they'd ever seen before.
In the rush for money, in the massive growth of populations, what you can get is a complete despoilation of the landscape. So I've got a picture of Oldham, a view from Oldham in the 1870s, where you can count 71 mill chimneys from it. 71 mill chimneys looking across the Lancashire Plain towards Manchester. And you can't see a tree.
But among the literal gloom of industrial takeoff, there was at least one tangible bright spot. Workers were better off in Manchester than anywhere else. Factories couldn't hire people fast enough, and this was particularly good news for women. Dr. Jill Liddington from Leeds University is an expert on women's experiences in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
For women who went to work in factories and mills, it was the nearest you got to equal pay. Particularly in the weaving sheds and all over the big cotton towns like Preston, Burnley, Blackburn. And in those weaving sheds, you get male weavers and women weavers weaving pretty much side by side. And the pay difference was something like 4 shillings. 20p, and that is staggering.
Well, that's
absolutely
different
staggering
than any other industry, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I live in West Yorkshire, and there it's the worsted and wool industry, and you don't get, A, the vast numbers of women working, nor do you get anything like approximating to equal pay.
When Alex de Tocqueville visited here in 1832 and wrote his graphic account of the city, he was no mere voyeur. He was one of a long line of commentators who came here because they understood that what was happening in Manchester, in all likelihood, would impact on their world too.
This area here was actually attracting tourists from Europe and indeed from North America, who came here to ponder what in fact was happening as they saw this industrial development occurring around the basin.
Even before 1800, you've got the makings of what becomes industrial Manchester.
Absolutely.
Right around us here.
Absolutely. The first guidebook to Manchester, and I think this would surprise a lot of people, the first guidebook to Manchester was published in 1783. And that guidebook, it took them here, it brought them right here to the canal basin and said, look, this is what Manchester is. This is what Manchester is all about. It's all about industrial change.
Across the other side of the city centre, it is possible to get a tangible notion of how life changed for the city's population. On Thomas Street, in yet another grim industrial area I knew in my youth, now turned into a trendy area of clubs and shops, there's a row of houses, and Hannah Barker has studied what happened to them and who lived there.
They're quite small buildings, 3 stories high, 2 rooms on each floor, but even if you're working and living in the same building, even by modern standards, that's not particularly cramped.
No.
By the time you get to the censuses of the 19th century, there are many families living on each floor, 1 family per room, and including in the cellars. Now, that shows both that this street's gone down in the world a bit, because now it's occupied not by relatively well-off traders, but by very poor people. But it also shows the great pressure on housing stock in central areas of Manchester.
By 1850 and 60, with Salford and the townships, which are technically the city of Manchester, you've got 500,000. Now, what I'm talking about 500,000 is no more than probably about 4.5 miles by 3.5 miles. So when you compare it to those burgeoning cities of the Far East, say the Chinese cities and the Indian cities, it's a very direct correlation, because you would have cities, streets, packed with people. People living in the street, often. Well, they lived in a house, but then they went onto the street for parties, and they went onto the street for their social engagement. So it is very much a prototype of those boom cities that come from nowhere.
And today, the most elegant monument to the wealth and power created by those masses of people is probably the Town Hall. You can't grow up in Manchester and not be impressed by it. imperious on the outside. Inside, it looks a lot like the Houses of Parliament in London, and it's often used as a double for film and television productions. But my guide, Jonathan Schofield, has brought me here for very different reasons.
It's a Gothic building, and it sums up Manchester's history on the outside. And right at the top, which I love looking at, it's a big golden ball with spikes on it, which is as big as me. And it's two symbols. It's a cotton pod about to burst and give out cotton, because that had been the foundation of Manchester's greatness. But it was also the sun. So by 1877, they're saying, wherever the sun shines, Manchester has interest or influence with our ideas or our products. That lovely bit of arrogance of the burgeoning city.
Ironic that they should feel that about a town that's reputed not to see the sun very often.
Well, we can always say now, because of that, the sun always shines in Manchester at some point in the city. Shall we now go inside and have a look?
Let's do that.
Well, you can see how the tone is now set by the splendour around you, including the gold leaf there in the mosaics above us of the cotton plants, to show that, again, Manchester has this global reach, not just a local reach. Often in major public buildings in other cities around the world, you might have, I don't know, the big military leader or a king. Here in Manchester, as you walk in, you get two scientists. One who came up with the first atomic theory, John Dalton, and one who invented, or who has the unit of energy, one should say, named after him, James Prescott Joule, who's the son of a brewer from Salford. And he got into his law of thermodynamics that way. So every cornflake packet in the world has KJ written on the back of it, which is kilojoule, which is named after him and the unit of energy. I think, to begin with, the area is different from, say, London or many other parts of the UK, because it was later described as the least aristocratic city in the UK. The lords and ladies around here tended to be quite minor, not very important, so they actually themselves invested in industry. But pretty soon you had very much a nonconformist radical elite who were taking over the running of the city. Remember, radicals of a nonconformist nature until the 1820s couldn't be members of parliament. They had no official status whatsoever. So often those energies were channeled into other things, industry and also politics and thinking about the way society is.
And nobody had more radical thoughts than two Germans who came to the city, one as a visitor, the other as an emigre. I speak, of course, of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, the fathers of communism. And for their story, we need to return to Chatham's library, in the company of the deputy head librarian, Fergus Weil.
But they first came here in the 1840s, right at the beginning of their collaboration.
There's an alcove here that sort of sticks out of the library, and it looks like a kind of workspace. Is this where either of them worked?
We know they did. They talk about the weather always being good. You'd sit here then, undoubtedly, because it's the lightest place to read.
And this is the place where they actually began the research for what became the Communist Manifesto.
That's right. They come here on a specific research trip. Engels' family firm are associated with Manchester. They've got offices here and a mill here at Weest. And here is where they begin studying the nature of the industrial society, the nature of industrial wealth and industrial poverty. Engels, indeed, right outside Cheetham's here in one of the worst slums in the town, writes it all up for his book, Condition of the English Working Class.
Well, we have the very table that Engels and Marx worked on, and it's in a little kind of cubbyhole, seems to be tucked away on the side of the library, very ecclesiastical, and yet it actually is the centre of a study that became a kind of world-famous classical text. This is the table they worked on.
This is the table they worked on, that's right. We've got the receipts from the carpenters from the 1650s. It's purpose-made for this space. They've been here ever since. So we know for a fact it's the one they worked on, although they didn't scratch their names on it very kindly.
There are, I suppose, a number of shrines to events in this city that we will come across, but this one still has exceptional resonance.
I get these visitors up and they weep to touch the books. It doesn't always work like that. I took some former Soviet Union people around, Russian of course now, they touched the books and went, all right. But then when we passed in Chorlton an old cinema where the Bee Gees first performed as very young boys, then they broke into Saturday Night Fever singing it. So, you know, Communist Manifesto, Saturday Night Fever, it's a broad church.
There was an event early in the 19th century which, in the public mind, established Manchester as a place where the liberal middle classes and working population were beginning to fight back against the terrible privations of factory life.
Normally in the city, we've had incredibly significant things. The free trade movement, you can talk about lots of movements, perhaps, but very rarely do you have moments where you can put your finger on it. And August the 16th, 1819, is definitely one of them, the day of the Peterloo Massacre.
And this is the actual site of the massacre itself?
It was indeed. You had, well, people argue, but between 60,000 and 120,000, we normally say about 80,000 people, gathered here in St. Peter's Fields in Manchester, and the people would have been facing east to where there was a cart with speakers on, one of whom was a man called Hunt. And he was there with a big white top hat on so people could see him. And he was talking about extending the vote to everybody. Well, mainly men, although he had sympathy for the female vote, and also getting representation for these very large towns. Manchester had grown so quickly, there, and the other towns in the north, really, that they didn't often have adequate representations.
Is that why so many people turn up to listen to it? Because that these are people, huge numbers of them, with genuine grievances.
Absolutely, and they had nobody to go to around here.
It was an attack, wasn't it, by the yeomanry. How many people were killed?
Well, it was a very British massacre. I mean, there was 15 people killed, we think, overall. It was drunken militia, probably, who couldn't control the horses, got separated, lashed out with their swords when the Riot Act was read. And then the field was cleared by professional soldiers, and that's why it gets its name.
But why,
they
it,
fought at Waterloo.
Why should it be called a massacre with what looks like a very small number of deaths? I mean, it doesn't register on the scale of things.
No, it
these
doesn't.
Days.
But remember, again, let's go back to the importance of the Fourth Estate and the media here. There was a Times journalist with Henry Hunt, Orator Hunt. There were other journalists nearby, there were Manchester journalists nearby, and they saw what had happened, and immediately it happens.
So there's an immediate coverage given to this, in the way that today, of course, social media gives events an instantaneous coverage all around the world.
It was social media with a 24 hours delay. I think what's important about the Peterloo Massacre is there were loads of such incidents across Great Britain happening. It was a very repressive government at the time, worried of a French Revolution happening in the UK. The difference was the press were here in Manchester, and that is the only reason it became nationally famous, and the only reason it led to changes. Interestingly, it got branded as well. So this is St. Peter's Fields. People, one member of the crowd who died, John Lees, had fought at Waterloo. So some clever journalist comes up with the idea of putting St. Peter's Fields together with the Battle of Waterloo. You get Peterloo. And for a while after that, just like we say everything's now Watergate, you know, whatever something gate, it was Loo in Britain because it became the Peterloo Massacre. And it was just branding and media.
I am Professor James Walvin, and you are listening to A City United, the story of Manchester's impact upon the globe in the BBC World Service. In the second part, after the news, we will continue our story of how the thoughts and deeds of the people who lived and worked in this city continue to have a profound impact on the world.
Documentaries on the BBC World Service.
The Ibadi community in the Gulf state of Oman is welcoming to other branches of Islam.
In this mosque, we have aspects that represent every part of the world in order to make people feel that this is their home.
I have a lot of Shia friends and a lot of Ibadi friends.
You go together, hang out, go to their places, everything the same.
And the generous attitude of the country's monarch, Sultan Qaboos, has won him popular support.
I think in Oman's case, we have the quintessential example of benevolent dictator.
In this second Heart and Soul programme from Oman, Munira Shayad examines the Sultan's influence.
I'll be finding out why Oman's absolute ruler survived the Arab uprisings and asking whether Oman is particularly well-placed to mediate between the Sunni and Shia power blocks in the world.
Faith in Oman. Online at bbcworldservice.com.
I'm Professor James Walvin, and this is the BBC World Service. After the news, I'll be continuing the story of Manchester and its impact on the world. We've heard how cotton helped it become the shock city of the Industrial Revolution. In part two, we'll see how the city responded to its role of industrial pioneer and explore some of the political ideas that emerged. Join me, Professor James Walvin, for part two of A City United, here on the BBC World Service. But first, the news.
BBC News. The Interior Minister of Ukraine says that armed men in camouflage uniforms have taken over a police office in the eastern city of Slavyansk. Writing on his Facebook page, Arsen Avakov promised a strong response. Pro-Russian separatists in two other eastern Ukrainian cities are continuing their occupation of local government buildings. Voters in the tiny Himalayan state of Sikkim are voting today in the fourth stage of the world's largest election in India. Both national and local elections are being held in Sikkim, including the contest for a seat in the regional assembly, which is reserved for a Buddhist monk. A court in Pakistan has withdrawn the case against a nine-month-old baby who was accused of attempted murder, along with 12 other members of his family. Despite his young age, Musa Khan appeared in court in Lahore for a second time to face charges of attempting to kill police officers during a confrontation over electricity and gas supplies. A cyclone has battered the Australian state of Queensland, leaving thousands of homes without power. Tropical cyclone Ita made landfall as a Category 4 storm, bringing winds of up to 230 kilometres an hour to coastal areas. Ships and planes are continuing to hunt for any sign of the missing Malaysian airliner, 5 weeks after it disappeared. The search area in a remote part of the southern Indian Ocean has been narrowed. The Australian Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, said the team had a high degree of confidence that the transmissions it had picked up were from the plane's black box recorder. A Japanese cabinet minister has visited a controversial war shrine in a move likely to anger China and South Korea ahead of President Barack Obama's Asia tour later this month. Yoshitaka Shindo, the Minister for Internal Affairs, said he'd gone to the Yasukuni Shrine in a private capacity. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service, and welcome back to part two of The City United, the story of my hometown Manchester and its impact on the globe with me, Professor James Wolvin. In part one, I told how Manchester became the world's first industrial city, on the back of the cotton trade, and free of the influence of both the ruling classes and traditional merchant guilds, it became the fastest growing city the world had ever seen. The collision of great wealth and poverty produced a tradition of radicalism in thought and deed. Later in the programme, I will look in detail at some of these movements, which included free trade, women's rights, and some momentous work on science. But back at the Bridgewater Canal Basin, Terry Wyke and I reflect on some of the practical problems of being the world's first industrial city.
It is, of course, a very complex problem to, for instance, bring in a regular supply of cheap, clear water into a city, let alone, of course, to devise the infrastructure which would take away all of the waste and effluent from the city. And what I think we should appreciate that in the first half of the 19th century, those problems which are now being faced, whether it be in Brazil or in Indonesia or in China, in these cities which have also experienced this galloping urbanisation, were really faced here for the first time. They had to be worked out.
So how is that achieved? How are these problems overcome?
They're overcome to an extent by an overlooked but important group of engineers who solve some of the problems that are associated with, for example, constructing a reservoir 30 or 40 miles away from a major city and piping that water in without the use of any steam power, but simply through gravity into the city, or devising sewers of a particular size and shape which maximise the flow.
This is a real major innovation for urban life, isn't it, in Manchester?
It is, though Manchester has a tendency, as it were, to see itself often as being first in so many things. But there were Manchester scientists, Manchester engineers, who did, as it were, very basic, fundamental research into some of those problems which challenge us today.
As the city expanded, it also faced the challenge of how to move so many people around, especially as more and more citizens wanted to move their homes away from the shadow of their smoky workplaces.
The world's first railway line terminated in Manchester and began or ended in Liverpool, depending on which way you want to look at these things. When the railway began to spread out across the country in the late 1830s and the 1840s, one important development was the building of suburban railway lines. And here in Castlefield, in fact, we're sitting close to what is often seen as the world's first suburban railway line. There was also a system of horse-drawn omnibuses, and again Manchester seemed to have been very early in developing a regular horse-drawn omnibus service between the centre and the new suburbs.
Well, I think that's the lesson of Manchester. I think it is endlessly repeated. What you have to sort of do for these new cities that come from nowhere in some respects, they might have got a historical basis, but then suddenly explode on the scene, is you really have to have independently minded people. Otherwise, they do become subservient to whatever elite is within that country. So they have to be free thinking. They have to be saying, no, this isn't how you do it. We can do it like this. And actually, when we look at ourselves, and we're producing, in Manchester's case at the time, up to 50% of the exports of the nation in the 1830s, you're thinking, we will do our own thing.
It is worth repeating that although there were mills in the city, some big ones, it was at heart a commercial and service centre. Its great trick was to ensure that production in the region was traded in the city, and in many ways the heart of the city's success was the Royal Exchange, once the largest trading room in the world. Let's go inside. While industrial Manchester was all heat, steam and noise, something very different was happening here in the heart of Manchester. In the 19th century, this is where the commerce of Manchester took place. This was the very heart of Manchester itself. Now, Jonathan, there was a peculiar way they went about their business here, wasn't there?
One of the things that people would have been preoccupied in the early industrial city, again, as residents is everywhere, which is how do you ensure that people trade with each other in a fair way, in an equitable way? You would come in, meet your trader. If you fancied his goods from the particular warehouse down the way, you'd shake hands and that was the deal done. And then it was a matter of honour that you had to fulfil that transaction. And around the dome of the Royal Exchange here, there's a little message that probably, again, would resonate lots of places, because it says, "He who seeks eternal treasure must use no guile in weight or measure. So therefore, trade honestly, otherwise the whole thing might fall apart."
And speaking of banking, merchants carried on their business by largely circumventing the Bank of England, which had tried to muscle in on trade by setting up a branch here in the 1840s. Philippa Cave, a guide to the city's industrial past, tells me about it in The Crown and Kettle, a grand old pub in whose snug portraits of some of the city's great men stare down around the open fire.
From about the middle of the 18th century and towards the end of that, various local men, the sort of men who are paying for Manchester's hospitals, they're trustees of Manchester's schools, they're very upright members of the community as we would see them, and they come together and start their own banks. You get the stock banks where their shares are issued to local men who want to be involved in this sort of venture. There's nothing greedy or sensationalist about them. Everything was very much done on trust, and these bank managers, as maybe we'd refer to them now, would have known who they're lending to.
And trust is the lubricant of business. In fact, inside the Royal Exchange, Manchester men strike a deal by shaking hands. Now, if you really wanted a contrast to the kind of what's happened to banking today, it is the disappearance of trust, isn't it?
And being completely divorced from the person who's actually lending you money is part of a series of transactions that who actually understands, even the bankers themselves, I'm not sure entirely do. In 1825, there was a worldwide depression. Banks collapsing, 1825, not 2008. And some of the Manchester banks managed to survive this, though. And it's thought that they've done that because they haven't issued their own banking notes. So there couldn't be a run on them, as we'd see today. They'd acted prudently and sensibly, and quite cautiously as well.
This spirit of determined independence led to the emergence of a new creed, the polar opposite of Marxism, free trade. Its two most famous proponents were Richard Cobden and John Bright, who said that unfettered capitalism, free of restriction and tariffs, was the surest path to world peace and an end to poverty. So powerful had Manchester become associated with it that the city's largest public hall was named the Free Trade Hall, still the only public building to be named in the UK after a concept. Of course, now it's a hotel, as is the way of these things.
The true free traders, Richard Cobden and John Bright, they actually believed that free trade was a mechanism of freeing the common person and the people all around the world to trade with each other freely. So therefore you don't have the elites and the establishment thinking along purely nationalist thoughts of military glory, of military conquest. You're saying, well, we forget all the armies and the navies, because now people can actually send products to each other. Of course, it helps when you're the biggest nation in the world industrially to have a competitive advantage. But the working people, of course, with the Chartists, felt something slightly different. And then, of course, you get the third people coming in, which is some Germans, it begins with, of course, Engels and Marx in Manchester and London, who start thinking and defining communism. Mm. And then other people within the locality may have adopted it, but it was always a bit too far for lots of people.
What about the impact of the philosophy of free trade into the 20th century? Are there any connections?
You can't break the link. What you have in the late 19th century is Britain becoming free trade, deliberately becoming free trade. And it was an absolute philosopher. Winston Churchill became a Member of Parliament for Manchester because he left the Conservative Party because they were ditching free trade in the early part of the 20th century. So absolutely, and what happens is, of course, then you get more protectionism, the world wars, and then you could almost say Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, they come up, they rediscover liberalism, and then, well, it's never stopped really since then, has it? The growth of the globalised world, the new economies coming in the Far East, India, other places, Brazil, they are taking advantage of this globalised world, which is in effect a very twisted version of what Cobden and Bright were aiming for back in the 19th century.
There's another aspect to Manchester of the 19th century, and you still see it in the fast-expanding towns of the world today, from Sao Paulo to Shenzhen. As Hannah Barker, who has studied the census records of the time, explains.
One of the striking things you notice about migration to towns like Manchester in the 19th century is you get more women coming than men.
Women coming on their own?
Women coming on their own, or often to join other family members. And you'd come to a town like Manchester because you think there'll be a job for you here. Right. And that might be in cotton, but it also might be in domestic service, or it might be in a shop.
And presumably, once you've come and you bring other relatives with you later, you have the kind of array of contacts to help them get work and settle in.
Absolutely, and that's what people still do today.
I've come here to a couple of terraced houses. Once, they formed part of a well-to-do street, which, incidentally, I used to pass most days on my way to school over the road there. But today, they got a curious sight, swamped by the city's massive hospital complex, the Manchester Royal Infirmary. The blue plaque outside one of them gives a clue as to why they've escaped the bulldozer. It reads,
Emmeline Pankhurst, 1858 to 1928, and Dame Christabel Pankhurst, 1880 to 1958, campaigners for women's suffrage, lived here.
And inside I'm meeting Dr. Jill Liddington from Leeds University, who is leading authority on the struggle for women's rights in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
I think the parlour's the most atmospheric room, isn't it? This is where it all started. What makes Manchester so very special is it is the city at the centre of this industry, so vast, of which women play an actually central role. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Votes for Women movement really found its home and its cradle in Manchester.
But one thinks of the early days of the suffrage movement as a kind of middle-class movement.
The early days of the women's suffrage movement in Manchester, two people really emerge. One is Dr. Richard Pankhurst, and the second person was Lydia Becker, and she was one of those women who never quite found a niche, a vocation for herself, and she became secretary of the Manchester suffrage movement for about a quarter of a century, and she really gave it shape. And what's remarkable about the Manchester story, and I'd argue it's sort of unequalled anywhere else, is that it's the coming together of a radicalised female workforce and this intelligentsia of in and around the Manchester University and South Manchester. And it was magic.
Emmeline Pankhurst is perhaps the most famous campaigner for the woman's vote, but it was two women who came to Manchester in the 1880s who did much of the spade work, knitting together a political coalition among working women, Eva Gore Booth and Esther Roper. They were interested in votes, not only for middle-class women, but for all women, and their efforts led to one of the largest petitions to Parliament to date, more than 30,000 signatures. It failed, however, and led to Emmeline Pankhurst deciding that more drastic action was needed.
October 1903, she said, right, come to my house and we will start a new campaign. So who did she say it to? Well, it was the women she knew around Manchester. And a very small group met here in the parlour, in this room, And Mrs. Pankhurst said, we're going to form a new suffrage organisation that's going to be really effective, and we're going to call it the Women's Social and Political Union, the WSPU. And so she did. And so the beginnings of the suffragette movement started in this house, in this room.
But it was a protest by her daughter Christabel, 3 years later, that proved the turning point in the campaign.
Christabel Pankhurst, with Annie Kenny, who was a mill worker from Oldham, they get tickets for this big meeting where the great and the good of the Liberal Party ministers and politicians are on the platform, and they listen to the Liberal politicians promising heaven on earth after the general election of January 1906. And then Christabel Pankhurst, when it comes to questions, stands up and says, when will the Liberal government give votes to women? And nobody takes any notice. And Annie Kenny then stands up, when will the Liberal government give votes to women? Pandemonium, the Liberal Party stewards hustle them out onto the pavement outside the Free Trade Hall. Christabel Pankhurst is by now sufficient of a lawyer, legal law student, to know that she needs to commit some technical assault to get arrested. And so the least technical assault she could do was a quick spit, a sort of technical spit. They are both arrested. They appear before the magistrates' court a couple of days later and get just under a week each of imprisonment. And one of the popular newspapers, which are becoming more and more important in Edwardian Britain, conjure up this new name, no longer suffragists, but suffragettes. And somehow the name stuck. And from that moment, October 1905, the suffragette movement really began to take off and gain tremendous momentum.
At the same time that the women's suffrage campaign was underway, Manchester was battling a worldwide depression. Its solution typified the city's response to adversity, and the century ended with another first, the largest civil engineering project in the world, the Manchester Ship Canal. Anywhere else, the notion would have been preposterous, but not in Manchester, which was used by now to confronting the impossible if it meant making money. Terry White takes up the story.
There had already been one spectacular example of a canal being built. That was the Suez Canal. But to build a canal between the Mersey estuary, 30 miles away from where we're sitting, into the very centre of Manchester, was, to say the least, an ambitious project. Although there were numerous problems, in 1894, the project was completed.
The investment paid dividends, not only in avoiding heavy port duties in Liverpool, where you can imagine there was much unhappiness with it, but it also paved the way for another first and proved to be the launch pad for the Manchester institution I hold dearest, Manchester United.
It also saw the building of what Mancunians sometimes refer to as the world's first industrial estate. This was Trafford Park. They managed to attract a great deal of foreign capital and foreign businesses to establish themselves.
Yes. Chaz, what kind of companies came here?
Well, American businesses in particular, Westinghouses. The first Ford cars in Europe were assembled in Manchester, in Trafford Park. You get the building of what was at the time one of the country's largest football stadiums. Unsurprisingly, when you had well-paid workmen knocking off work on Saturday at dinner time with money in their pocket, a particular club, I think it's known in some parts of the world today, Manchester United, decided to relocate their stadium, and they placed it directly, almost as it were, at the gates of Trafford Park.
Today, the world over, it's recognised that a nation's well-being rests on the education of its people. But in 19th century England, that wasn't the case. You couldn't attend the four existing universities at the time if you weren't an Anglican, still less teach in one. Manchester University broke new ground by launching as a nonconformist institution in 1880. The university's historian is Dr. James Hopkins.
So Oxford and Cambridge and those ancient universities had really had a curriculum which had stayed the same for an awfully long time, and their methods have stayed the same for an awfully long time. They were preparing gentlemen, and of course it was gentlemen, not ladies. But then also it did something that was groundbreaking, and it realised one of the purposes and one of the values for a university was to conduct research and to make knowledge from research readily available to those people who were trading, who were developing new techniques for industry in the city.
So it's related to the kind of city it grows from, that it has a kind of utilitarianism in a way that old universities and old colleges in England didn't have.
Absolutely, it had a real mix of idealism and seeking to offer something of great importance with a utopian vision on the one hand, but then had very practical ambitions at the same time. And I suppose in that way, it was also being pragmatic about its own future.
And what a future it has had. Manchester has had 25 Nobel Prizes awarded for work here, the most recent for the discovery of graphene, a new wonder substance which it is reckoned will become the new star of material science this century. But having visited Karl Marx's desk and Emmeline Pankhurst's front room, there are two other locations of similar importance, and they nestle just behind the magnificent neo-Gothic facade of the main building. Well, we're actually standing in part of the laboratories that were used by Ernest Rutherford and his nuclear family, and where they first split the atom. James, tell us something about it.
Rutherford was a New Zealander and came to Manchester to work. It's here where they caused the atom to transmutate from one type of atom to another. And so really it's the home of nuclear physics.
The curious thing about it from someone my age is that it looks remarkably like an old school classroom with the tiles up halfway up the wall, with the wooden benches, which presumably were lecture benches, and wooden desk here that was a workbench, is that right?
Yep, I mean, really, I mean, the lab was very utilitarian. It was here for a purpose. There was tiles on the wall that could be wiped clean. The equipment that survives isn't really remarkable. It's just the type of equipment that was used at the time. What was remarkable was the minds of the people who used it.
Ernest Rutherford came from New Zealand to a university that is pioneering, that sets its stall out as being somewhere different, and where men of great imagination and brilliance can actually thrive in ways they could perhaps not elsewhere. And what emerges from this very ordinary-looking facility is one of the great breakthroughs, really, in modern science. Rutherford is perhaps the best known of the scientists, but of course the university attracted other men of great distinction who were pioneers in the field. And just around the corner is the world of Alan Turing.
So here we are in the room that Alan Turing worked in when he was at the university. I mean, now it's just a simple seminar room, and I think a lot of students don't appreciate they're in a space that was inhabited by a great mind of the 20th century. So he came to work here with people like Williams and Kilburn, who did some groundbreaking work during the Second World War on technologies like radar, and worked on the development of the world's first stored program computer. So effectively a computer that could be switched on and run a program directly. And Alan Turing was attracted to come to Manchester to work with people like that. Alan Turing was interested in questions such as, can computers think? And the applications of the computer, so enabling the computer to run calculations that would take an individual weeks and weeks.
So Turing, rather like Rutherford, comes here for the opportunities and the colleagues and the facilities, but also his work points us right into the future, that we're looking at the consequences of Turing's work that live with us in all kinds of ways. We carry it in our pocket with our smartphones, with our laptops at home.
Absolutely. At the university, we often call this, which is Coupland Street, the Street of Science, because in two buildings adjacent to one another, we really have the makings of the 20th century.
By the eve of the First World War, Manchester had lost its preeminence to rivals in Germany, the United States, and even elsewhere in Britain. Even so, the shock city of the Industrial Revolution remained a centre for radical thought and deed. The cooperative group, rooted in the ideas of the Manchester entrepreneur Robert Owen, is headquartered in the city. Manchester hosted the first Trades Union Congress in 1868, and the head office of the Vegetarian Society has been based here for nearly 200 years. In October 1945, one of the most important meetings in the struggle for independence in Africa and the Caribbean was hosted in the city. The fifth meeting of the Pan-African Conference was held in the heart of what is now Manchester Metropolitan University. Jonathan Schofield again.
Kwame Nkrumah, Jomo Kenyatta. Manchester always had links with different ethnic groups, not just
Africans right across the world. But in this particular instance, we did have groups in Manchester who owned restaurants, who had their own life here, that come across at various times through the last 40 or 50 years. There was also students here, a big African student population in Manchester, and it was due to be held in Paris, but unfortunately through various circumstances it was held in Manchester, which worked out very well for the organisers in terms of what they wanted to deliver.
It was the first such conference, stretching back to its foundation in 1905, attended by leaders of political parties in Africa, and was instrumental in developing the principles and strategy towards independence that was to bear fruit over the next 20 years. Waves of immigration continue to alter and to add to the makeup of the city. Today you can find an Arab street, a curry mile, a gay village and a Chinatown, as well as substantial Afro-Caribbean and Irish communities. In the 50 years since I left, it has established a worldwide identity, not only through its football clubs, but through youth culture. The rain falls hard on a humdrum town. This town has dragged you down. Manchester bands are admired the world over, from the Smiths, with a peculiar appeal in Latin cultures around the world, to Joy Division and New Order, who recorded on the appropriately named Factory Records. C.P. Lee lectures on film studies at Salford University and is an expert on Manchester's musical and cultural history.
People thought, why go to London? Why do you need to go to London? Oh, well, to make a record. And they realised that they could make records here. There were some very good recording studios, like Strawberry in Stockport, which belongs to 10cc. Then there were little four-track studios just down the road. So everything's in place to record.
I began this programme at Manchester City's ground. The modernist Etihad Stadium stands where once there was a wireworks and a coal mine. What was in the 1980s the quintessential post-industrial landscape has been transformed into a bold £1 billion regeneration project with a football club and Middle East money at its heart. My heart lies to the west at Old Trafford, where Manchester United, over the past 50 years, has set a standard to which successful football clubs all over the world now aspire. History, character, glamour and success. It must be something in the water. You've been listening to A City United in the World Service of the BBC, presented by me, Professor James Walvin, and produced by Kevin Mosley. The BBC World...